Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another special, exciting edition of the Big Red Bus as we take the glorious monstrosity out onto the rainy streets, snowy streets of Chicago in April. I look to my right, and lo and behold, we have the great Kevin Anderson from NBC Sports Chicago. How you doing, brother?
I'm good, Fred, though that Big Red Bus has got a couple flat tires, I think, right now, unfortunately. I think we need to do a, repaint the bus. We need to maybe replace the upholstery inside the bus. We need to do some things on the outside to make the bus go a little faster. You know, the bus is limping along right now.
The muffler's are gone. The catalytic converter's gone. I mean, we're going strictly by wind sail that I have put up. But I got to tell you, I've really enjoyed your ascension to, you know, kind of like a podcasting titan.
Oh, that's very way overstated, but thank you.
MKC's ascension to, you know, teenage heartthrob on the video broadcast. That's the good thing about this year. You guys, along with that whole team, just exceptional chemistry. It's a gold standard of Bulls podcast. So I'm honored and humbled that you're jumping on to our large bus painted red.
Well, you and I have been doing podcasts for many years now, so this is nothing new for us. I will say when I get to host our Bulls Talk podcast, it's so easy because I just get to have a conversation with KC, right? And like, yeah. any one of us probably listening right now could have a great conversation with KC Johnson because he's so dialed in and so plugged in on what's going on around the team that all I literally have to do is ask questions that aren't stupid. So that's a low bar, but thank you. I have a lot of fun doing it. It's interesting because I all day with my job, I talk about the Bulls or watch the Bulls. And of course the White Sox and Blackhawks are part of that too, but I'm just doing what I normally do every day. Just it gets recorded and published and people listen to it. It's fun. I wish the team were doing a little bit better, so we had a championship contending team to talk about. I think everyone in the Bulls fandom wishes the team was, you know, where Boston was right now, even where Cleveland, New York are right now. That's the big thing. We want a consistent winner.
No doubt. Final note on your pod, as someone who's done this for many decades, you're an excellent point guard in that. You know, KC is a genius. He's very analytical. You have Jason who's a little bit more passionate, a little bit different. You're like the point guard, making sure that the shooting guard and the center get the touches. It's just a great listen. And anyone who listens to this show, who doesn't listen to what you guys do with Bulls Talk, I mean, it's insanity. You got to download it today. Anyhow, let's move on to the topic of at hand, which is the beloved Bull. I'd like to first start out, obviously this has been a quasi-disaster of a year. There have been some good things. Obviously, Kobe, Io, Caruso having a career year, DeMar having another excellent year. All that greatness has been counterbalanced with some negativity and injuries to Williams and Zach and Vooch's downturn from the three-point line. But what two players on the Bulls have disappointed you the most? Like,
well, can I give you one player and one aspect? Can we split the difference there? So first, in terms of player, and I think most people would agree, I'm most disappointed in Nikola Vucevic's play this season. His shooting as of right now with us recording is averaging 28.5 from the 3-point line, which is not good, not anywhere in line with what he used to be in his career. The disappearance of his 3-point shot is the biggest concern and disappointment I have right now with the team because of how many minutes he gets and how important the 3-point shot is to the offense and the league, specific to his position and what he's done in his career. It's been difficult, and Vucevic is not a good defensive center. There are a lot of issues with the pick and roll and a lot of issues with the team 3-point defense that are because of Vucevic and trying to help out on drives. But that being said, if he were shooting more in line with 35% instead of 28%, this team would be a lot better. Like the volume of shots he gets, you know, he's averaging over 4 3-point shots a game. If he were to be connecting on 35% of those shots, we'd be in a much healthier spot. I mean, like, think of it this way. Last year, he hit 34.9% of his threes. Just 2 years prior to that, he was hit 40%, 38%, 40.6% the year before that. Actually, the split year with Chicago and Orlando in the trade. So He has done that consistently in his career. Hit those threes on a much higher clip. That's the biggest disappointment to me, from a player standpoint, is just his play. Because the rebound totals are always going to be there, but his fit in the offense really, really needs him, especially with DeRozan playing alongside of him. You can't have two players who are mid-range offensive players in today's game. You can't. And so you need him to be able to hit a three, and it's not there. So that's the biggest disappointment from a player standpoint. For me, from a team aspect, the biggest disappointment's been the drop off the defense. They were fifth in defense last year, in defensive rating, and they're 20th as of right now. That is a significant drop off, and they are the worst team in the league defending the three. No one gives up more 3-point attempts than the Chicago Bulls, and it's been, and nobody gives up more open and wide open looks, and that's actually a defined metric by the NBA with their tracking stats. No one literally gives up more combined open and then wide open shots, 3-point shots, than the Chicago Bulls. So the drop off of the defense from where they were last year to where they are this year has been a little bit surprising, because the roster isn't inherently that different than it was last year. But to go from fifth to 20th in one season, especially now, you could argue Patrick Williams is part of that, and I think you'd absolutely agree, and he'd be a big part of that. But like, give it this number, not just the rankings. Last year, their defensive rating, which by anybody who has even dipped their toe into basketball analytics, you never want to look at like points per game and opponents' points per game as like the defined metric of how a defense is doing. You need to look at offensive and defensive rating, because it's then filtered out pace. You don't take into account pace. It's about per 100 possessions. And so it's a much better, cleaner way of defining good offense, efficient offense, bad defense, efficient defense. So last year, they had a defensive rating of 111.5, which was fifth in the NBA, just behind Milwaukee, Memphis, Boston, and Cleveland, four very, very good defenses. And then when you get into this year, in terms of defensive rating, they are 20th at a 115.6 clip. That is a significant fall off from last year.
Absolutely.
And like, it's interesting when I look, I love looking at numbers and advanced stats, which I don't even consider defensive rating would be that advanced, but the teams around them in defensive rating are either really bad teams or they have exceptional offenses. For instance, the LA Clippers are 18th in defensive rating at 115.3. The Dallas Mavericks are 19th in defensive rating at 115.5. The Brooklyn Nets are 115.6, 21st. Then you've got the Spurs, Portland, Indiana behind that, Toronto, Detroit, Atlanta, Washington, Charlotte, and Utah. And so the teams where they are, if they're good teams, it's because of their exceptional offenses. And the Bulls don't have an exceptional offense, and so they're right there with the bad teams in the NBA in that regard. And so the drop off of defense from last year to this year has been probably my biggest disappointment as a Bulls observer and as a fan, just because it's been kind of unexpected from my end. And certainly, I think, we could talk about Zach LaVine and his situation and what they probably or may want to do in the summer. But as we all know, Zach is not a good defensive player. And so you would think that losing his minutes, you would become a little bit better, or even just as good defensively. But there's been a significant drop off. And that's been the biggest surprise and disappointment to me from a team standpoint.
I'm so glad you answered the question about, the most disappointing player correctly, because
Oh,
I think
I didn't know there was a one correct answer there.
there was one clear one to me, because most people would point to Zach, and my counter is he's been injured. By that definition, Lonzo would be the most disappointing player if you're gonna say, hey, Zach's been the most disappointing. Well, he's been injured, and I always see the traditional and older analysts as, part of Team Will, Stacey Kendall. They're always pointing to our negligence of getting the ball into Vooch in the post. And that's an inefficient way to play the game today. There's a reason teams don't do that anymore, because it's not efficient. And he's not an efficient offensive player. So what are we going to waste time trying to do 1989 back to the basket? I feel like you're constantly pushing, you know, the team over there. And I'm, when I mean team, like the broadcast team, and the correctly analyzing the problem. And it's imperative that we, you know, kind of correctly diagnose what the issue is. You cannot have Vooch as the center of the offense and the hub of the offense, which was, it seems to me, like a kind of like a directive early on in the season. If he's going to shoot like this, you just can't do it, because you don't demand enough respect from the D. He's not a Draymond level passer where you could still get away with that. We don't have enough incredible shooters on the team to make that work. So I feel like he is the reason, like, this has taken a significant downturn. I mean, to be shooting 28% on that type of volume from three, it's just catastrophic for the ceiling of this offense. And then, and as a counter on the defensive end, he's the reason we're not guarding the three-point line, because, number one, we can't protect the paint because he's such a horrible rim defender. We're bottom 10 in the league in rim defense, even though we got everybody helping out to protect the paint, because he can't do that. And then that leads to open three-pointers. It's pretty simple to me. Am I misdiagnosing the issues on the defensive end? Like, to me, it starts and ends with him.
Well, so let me say, from an offensive end, I think you are undervaluing his passing ability and his playmaking ability a little bit. I think he is a very good playmaker. And there, you're right, there was talk on Media Day last, what it was, October 1st, and they're in the course of training camp, that they were going to make a more concerted effort to have Vooch be a little bit of that playmaker. And I think it was probably not that dissimilar to what we saw from Joakim Noah a little bit as the point center during those Tibbs years. What was it, the year that that
2015, finished 10 years ago? Yeah,
he finished exactly. Top five in MVP voting, defensive player of the year. He was an incredible playmaker, right, in the sense, yeah, in the middle there. And I think the idea was not necessarily to compare Vucevic to Nikola Jokic, but Vucevic does have a good playmaking sense. He's a very good passer. He's a willing passer. He's a good playmaker. He's got good vision. And so I will say, from that aspect of it, I get the approach, but the problem is, for the rest of the team, for me, from like a spacing standpoint, from a concept standpoint, when you have Vucevic in the middle, DeRozan, we know, isn't a very willing or efficient 3-point shooter. He's incredibly efficient in the mid range, but he's not really that efficient from the 3-point shot. So you then have a little bit of a spacing issue with Vucevic and DeRozan there. And then when you add in the double big lineup of Drummond, which is something that has been used really in the latter half of the season more consistently, you've got someone else who just cannot space the floor. And so when you have Drummond, Vucevic, and DeRozan on the court at the same time, your offensive spacing is not conducive to getting 3-point shots, which is a big issue in my mind. Correct. So you then have to go, well, okay, we need to space out Vucevic a little bit. And Vooch has been getting a lot of open shots, specifically like corner threes, but he's just not been hitting them on a consistent clip. And to your point, from a defensive standpoint, it's interesting to me from a number. So the Bulls' defensive rating with Vucevic on the floor is 116.6. That's not good. That's really not good at all. Their opponent effective field goal percentage with Vucevic on the floor is this season's 55.9, which is not good at all. And so those are two big impacts, that when Vooch is on the floor, the defense is just not, it's not good. And so I think part of the issue, and this gets back to the 3-point shooting, the opponent 3-point shooting, I think part of the issue is that this team is so concerned about stopping drives, mm-hmm, that when they, at the point of attack on a pick and roll, and this is something that Billy was asked specifically about a couple games ago. He was asked, you know, what is, in Billy's opinion, the biggest reason for the opponents having such success in 3-point shooting? And Donovan, a great answer, but he specifically said, he didn't go name any players, but he specifically said, we have issues with the point of attack on the pick and roll when teams set that up, and that they end up getting 3-point shots because of overcorrections on the Bulls' defensive end with the rotations, right? And so he says it all starts with the point of attack on the pick and roll or the screen and roll, whatever teams are doing to that initial action to set that up. And I think he didn't say it, but I think the step further from my standpoint is the team is so concerned about drives and stopping drives on that with how they are using Vucevic, and they're concerned about Vucevic getting beat on the drives, that the other defenders are already pre-helping and shading over in that moment. And then the defense breaks down when the passes and the kickouts start happening in that moment. And that's when you get these open threes. And so I think a big part of that is Vucevic with that. I think it absolutely is. Now, from a concept standpoint and a team standpoint, I would prefer them not to be that concerned about drives and just say, hey, we're not going to help as much because we're getting killed by the three on this. And I would like to see them do that more, but I understand from Donovan's point of view, he thinks they will get absolutely cooked every single play, especially against athletic point guards and athletic guards.
I agree.
In this, that he doesn't want to give up that initial in the paint easier shot. He wants to force teams to hit more difficult shot with a 3-point shot is obviously a layup is more efficient than a 3-point shot. And so I get his standpoint there, but I think it all comes down to how they're defending the initial actions and the point of attack with the screen and rolls and the pick and roll. And I think it all collapses from there. And I think they're so concerned about defending the drives that it's causing the issues on the back end with the threes.
You're absolutely right. Everything you said is 100% correct. Even though we're so concerned about the drives, I do agree with Billy. We're still 21st in the league in field goal percentage at the rim. It's unbelievable how bad we're trying to stop drives, and because we can't defend the rim. If we don't, I mean, we'll be 30. There's no doubt about it. Like I totally get that. And I think he's just, it's like, it's a no-win situation. I think he's just gambling that, you know, hopefully we'll beat teams that on nights when they're missing threes. Cause it's damned if you do, damned if you don't, when he's on the court.
Yeah. And I want to also point out, I don't think this is entirely on Vucevic, right? Because Vucevic is off the floor. The defense isn't that much better.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you were seeing this huge, like Vucevic on the floor, defense rating was 116.6. And then if he was off the floor, it was like 110. I think then like the clear reason is, well, it's Vuce, right? But it's not. The defense isn't that much better with Vuce off the floor. So this isn't truly just one player causing the entire issues, because they've got issues all around. And whether it's a scheming, whether it's the roster, whether it's the player's ability, maybe all of the above. But this isn't just like, hey, trade Vuce, or when Vuce sits, the defense is fine, because they're not. It's across the board. The defense is not working this season.
Well, it's definitely roster. Our interior defense has sucked for several years. And, you know, when we and specifically around rim defense, Drummond is not that much of an improvement. He's better, but not that much of an improvement. I think that's seen in the numbers. It's like when you have your guy leading your team in block shots is Alex Caruso, there's a problem. Like that should never be a non-four or five leading your team there. And
it is Caruso, though. It is going to be first team all NBA defense.
Yeah, and that's part of my counter is, like, I think he's clearly one of the best five defenders in the league on the perimeter.
Yes.
We have Io, who's very good. Patrick Williams, when he's healthy, is good. We have, like, some – Craig is a good perimeter defender. Like, I think our perimeter defense is – and I think Kobe's played better defensively on the perimeter this year. It's like, to me, that's not the issue. I think we're at average or above average on the perimeter. It's the interior defense that is so bad. It's a layup line in a lot of these games. And what you're seeing is, like, I really noticed it in the Cleveland, even though we won in overtime, starting in that game, the subsequent games after that, Dallas, the Clippers, even Atlanta recently, all you're doing is seeing teams hunting for that, the pick and roll. Let's get Vuce out and let's try to get him on a guard or make force him into a switch. If he comes and does his drop, then the guy rolls and it's a dunk. It's like, it's a nightmare, and it just happens over and over again. And we cannot have another offseason where this problem is not addressed. I know 3-point shooting is an issue. Like, are we ever going to get a four or five that can really defend the rim and be a force on the inside? Like, we really haven't had one. When was the last guy, Gafford, that we had that really did a good job of protecting the rim? It's unbelievable.
Wouldn't you love Daniel Gafford on this team right now?
Yes.
I like or a rim running time. Big. Like the success he's having in Dallas is like I'm happy for him. Like the fit with him and Luka is just absolutely working. Like he obviously Washington's not a very good team. And so like he got caught in like kind of two bad situations with his Bulls tenure and the Wizards. And now he's thriving in Dallas, but like a rim running big who can protect the rim, like sign me up. Like, it, but it's unfortunate that, you know, it, obviously hindsight is 2020 there, but like he would be very good on this Bulls team. I would love to see Gafford, but he's thriving in Dallas and I'm happy for him and good for him.
Absolutely. On to the next topic. I wanted to go into assuming that it's I think it's pretty clear. It's going to be a play-in for the Bulls, either at 9 or 10.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll win that game. The chances of them winning the next one are slim to none. And, you know, missing the playoffs again, I'd like to talk about the ramifications of that. Like, DeMar is going to be an unrestricted free agent. Number one, do you think they're going to re-sign him? Most importantly, if you do, what is the max you would agree to? And then the last part of the question is, if the Bulls don't make the play, if let's say they lose the play-in, the first play-in, 9 versus 10, do you feel that it's possible that this could be it for this front office, or do you think they're going to get another opportunity?
I don't see a front office change. There's a lot to unpack there. So first, let's make the assumption that they don't make it out of the play-in, which could they beat Atlanta? Absolutely, right? And especially if they end up with what happened earlier this week aside, if they're at the United Center, I think, you know, given that they'll have 2 days off in between because of the Sunday, last Sunday, the regular season, they play the Knicks. They may be resting players in that game because they're locked into their seed, may already be in there. They'll have Monday and Tuesday off, and that 9-10 playing game is on that Wednesday. I think if they play Atlanta, there's a good chance that they end up winning that game. Now, the three-point issues aside, and also, guess what? Trae Young may be back at that point. It could be very different how it looks. We know Joel Embiid is back with the Sixers. But, like, you look at the 7-8 matchup, that's my concern. Because right now, the 7-8 matchup is Miami and Philly. Now, that could change. Indiana could drop back a little bit, and I think the Bulls would have a much better shot against the Pacers, the other two Absolutely. Teams. But if you have to travel to Miami or travel to Philly with Joel Embiid for the right to be the 8 seed, either one of those matchups is extremely difficult for the Bulls, and then I don't like their chances in either game. So let's operate this hypothetical under the question of they miss the playoffs, right? Because that's honestly what they're looking at. So if they miss the playoffs, they will have had one playoff appearance since the 2017-18 season. That is, let's see, do the math here. 7 seasons. That'll be one playoff appearance in 7 seasons if they miss the playoffs this year. Like, that doesn't cut it for me, right? Like, no. being quote, competitive should not be a goal of this organization. If you are the Wizards or the Kings, even Memphis, your goal is to be competitive. If you're the Chicago Bulls, the bar should be much higher. The bar should, at the lowest, be set at perennial playoff contender. At the lowest. And honestly, the bar should be higher than that, right? But the steps to get there should be perennial playoff contender, conference title contender, NBA title contender. Like, those are the three rungs of that ladder. And so the bar for an organization that has won 6 titles and has had a history as good as the Bulls should be not to be competitive. It should be perennial playoff contender is the minimum there. So if they were to miss the playoffs, you're talking about once in 7 years, right, of making the playoffs. And even, let's be honest, that one appearance was a gentleman's sweep by the Bucks. So you have one playoff win in 7 years. They haven't been out of the first round since 2015. This is nearly a decade, Brad. So, yeah, it's just not like it's not in a healthy place where this team should be. To get to your DeRozan question, I kind of look at it from a different standpoint than just the simple in a vacuum, do you bring DeRozan back or you not, right? I think there's a lot of factors involved with that. Number one is their cap space usage and what they're going to do. They are going to be an over-the-cap team Unless they trade Zach LaVine to a team with cap space and take very little back in return for him, essentially just to unload Zach LaVine, which is an option. And we can talk more about that in a bit, but they're going to be an over the cap team. And so what that means is if you've got three significant free agents on this team. You've got Patrick Williams as a restricted free agent. You've got DeMar DeRozan as an unrestricted free agent. And then you have Andre Drummond, who you don't have bird rights to, who's also a free agent. And so what that means is if you were to let DeRozan walk, you are not re-signing an equal value player because you don't have cap space to do it. You essentially, the Bulls' options to improve their roster in free agency next summer are essentially limited to the mid-level. Which is kind of what they essentially did last summer, bringing Torrey Craig and Javon Carter in, which Carter has not worked out, I think, the way anybody has hoped. So, like, I'm a little disappointed in his play overall. And if you were to give me a second player, I was disappointed in terms of production behind Vucevic. It honestly would be Carter, just because I expected more from him. Craig has been hurt a little bit, but I've been fairly happy with Torrey Craig and what he does in the minutes he's on the floor. And so getting back to the DeRozan question, if you let DeRozan walk, who are you bringing in that is as good as a player as DeRozan using the mid-level, also realizing that you have other roster issues you have to fill because Drummond would have to be signed using cap space because you don't have his bird rights. We know there are multiple issues with getting more bigs on this roster. If you let Drummond walk, you have to sign another big, hopefully one that is a good rim protector. And so that then to me fundamentally comes back to DeRozan. And I think they almost have to bring DeRozan back because they would be a much worse team if they let him walk, a much worse team. Now, the question, of course, is what do you offer DeRozan and what is he willing to accept? As a UFA, he can do whatever he wants. He could sign with the Lakers for $10 million a year, and that's his prerogative, or he could re-sign with the Bulls at whatever they offer him, or he could go to another team. Given from what I know about how respected DeRozan is in that locker room and among that team and just how much value he brings to his teammates and on his production on the floor, I mean, like, let's get back to DeRozan and who he is as a player in 2024, right? He's not a 30 point per night guy. He's not going to be that guy again, right? Mm-hmm. At the same Correct. Time, he leads the NBA in minutes played. So even at his age, he is incredibly durable, has only had a few games that he's had to miss this season. And he's still bringing it every night. He obviously is very clutch in the fourth. He's second in the entire NBA in fourth quarter points scored. He still averaged 23.5 points a game. His 3-point percentage, I would like to be a little bit higher. He's 32.4 3-point this year, but that's who he is as a player, right? I don't think it's realistic to expect that number to go up significantly. He's a good playmaker. He's averaging 5.2 assists a game. Which, by the way, leads the team in assists, just a couple percentage points ahead of Kobe in that regard. And so
gets to the line.
Yeah, gets to the free throw line. Like, is great in those clutch minutes because he is a good calming presence. Like, with a bunch of young guys playing alongside of him in Kobe and Io, he's a very, like, calming presence in those moments. And the team has talked about that. They've, like specifically said how they lean on that. So, yes, the short answer, the recap, the too long didn't read answer to your question for me is, yes, I would re-sign DeRozan. In terms of the amount, I would hope you can get him for $20 to $25 million a year. But I also want to caution people who get too caught up, and this happens every July of free agency. A player will sign, and the fans of that team will go, he's not worth that amount. I don't want people, when they look at a number, I don't want them to look at $23 million, $28 million, $30 million. Number one, look at percentage of the cap. That's really what you should be looking at. And also realizing that the number that DeRozan signs this offseason with anybody the cap, the NBA is getting a massive influx of money in a couple of years with the new national TV deal. So the cap is going to continue to go up in that regard. So today's 20 million is really next year's 15 million, and 3 years from now is 10 million in that regard. Like, the average salary goes up, and I don't want people to get too caught up in, oh, he's not worth 20 million age, you know, 34, right? Like, he's still got a lot of pretty good years left. And I would like to see DeRozan back on this team, given that, to me, there are no better options. Even at par with him, there certainly aren't better options at a better player, and there are no better options as somebody of equal value to bring in free agency.
Oh, I can't agree with you enough. I mean, all the reasons you highlighted, I think there'd be a massive collapse without DeRozan. Like, yeah. If you're expecting, there's a large swath of the fan base that's kind of expects, you know, Patrick Williams to step in that role and thrive, and I think that's absolutely insane. Like, Patrick Williams can hit the three. He's better at DeMar at that, but he can't get to the line. He doesn't rebound. He doesn't pass well. He can't fill that hole. And to expect him to step in there is setting him up for failure and a team up for failure. I have major concerns about what would happen to this team if DeMar was off the roster. And I think it's possible we're going to see that, Kevin. I'll be honest with you. I foresee that the Sixers, let's just throw that team out there. Mm-hmm. They don't get, if they have a disappointing first round exit, what are they going to do? Who are they going to bring in? It's an immensely talented player. And I know people will point out, well, does he fit with Embiid? Yeah, he fits with Embiid. Everybody fits with Embiid. Like, he would fit with Embiid. He'd be an improvement from what they have now. I think I could see a team like the Sixers throwing a bunch of money at him. And I am a little concerned, like, in terms of a three-year deal at 35 a year. I think he's, if he wasn't, you know, at his age right now, how can you argue he's not worth 35 a year?
Well, that's like, a lot, Fred. Like, 35 a year, like a three-year, $115 million. That's a lot.
Like, what do you think he's worth?
I think, gosh, I mean, free agency is such an unknown because you don't know what certain teams with the cap space are going to offer somebody. You don't know what, like, Detroit is going to do, who's going to have significant cap space. DeRozan's played really well this year. I don't know if he's quite going to get to $30 million a year for – maybe I'm wrong. Like, he's obviously still playing a high level, and his game ages very well. It's not like we're going to expect a significant drop-off at age 35 or age 36 because his game doesn't really rely on athleticism. So I don't expect a big drop-off there. I'll put it this way. I'd be surprised if he got 35 a year. That number seems a little bit high to me. But at the same time, if the Bulls can get him for anywhere from 20 to 30, I think they probably pull the trigger on that. And then, see, the Patrick Williams thing's interesting because the kind of, like, overarching cloud that we have to recognize in this situation is the Bulls are not going to be in the luxury tax next year, right? That's ownership's right. Not going to approve a team that is a play-in contending team to be in the luxury tax, which I get. Like, I've got no issues with that at all because I probably wouldn't either. And so...
Agreed.
If Lonzo is back on the roster, and we're all pulling for Lonzo and think he is, Bulls are going to be in a really tough tax situation. And so I think it's unlikely that both DeRozan and Patrick Williams are on this roster next year.
Wow. That's a big statement. See, I'd be shocked that they're both not on the roster.
They're both not on the roster. Wow. I mean, I think for that to happen, just from a tax standpoint, you'd have to get a significant discount, if you will, from Patrick Williams.
What does he deserve $20 million a year for? What has he done?
There are teams, and again, I'll bring up Detroit only because they have cap space, but if there's a team out right now that believes in Patrick Williams' future, in his potential, they could sign him to an offer sheet that the Bulls are then going to have to go, we'll pass, right? Like, it's as an RFA, the Bulls have first rights of refusal there. But at the same time, Patrick and his agent can chop him around and sign an offer sheet. And then the Bulls will have 2 days to figure out if they're going to match that offer sheet. But if he signs an offer sheet with somebody, even at 15 a year, I don't know if the Bulls can stand the luxury tax if Lonzo's back. And here's the huge unknown. You're not going to know by July 3rd whether or not Lonzo's going to be back this season. You aren't. And so do you roll the dice as a front office and go, okay, we'll just wait and see. Now, the important thing about the luxury tax It is calculated at the end of the season, not at the beginning, at the end, after the trade deadline. So they could certainly go, well, let's see. And if Lonzo's back and they're $15 million over the tax on opening night, they won't be on closing night. I guarantee that. And they'll do some trades in order to unload salary and do whatever it takes. Now, the other big wrinkle of this is Zach LaVine. He makes a significant salary. And so, like to your point about Philly, could Philly then say, oh, maybe Zach LaVine's the missing piece? Maybe. I think a lot of teams are concerned about Zach's health, and they want to see him on the floor before they commit to his salary and assets. But if the Bulls are willing to trade Zach at a low return on investment there, they may be willing to do that. I mean, they've got to see what the offers are, but clearly their offers were not there that they were happy with at the trade deadline.
I think our only hope at moving Zach LaVine is a massive disappointing performance from one of those teams like the Lakers, the Sixers, mm-hmm. one of those teams that say that just get knocked out either in the play-in or maybe even the Warriors in the first round and say, you know what, we need to do something drastic and take a chance on a player like Zach. But I do feel like that's it. Like, I don't see him getting traded with that number, which leads me to my next question. What do you think is going to happen unless you attach an asset to it, like a first round pick? Like, what do you think the Bulls are going to do about Zach LaVine? Do you think he's back beginning of next season? I don't see any other choice unless they can somehow, you know, unload him to the Lakers if they disappoint.
I mean, the interesting part about your hypothetical about a team that disappointed, the four play-in teams in the West right now is Sacramento, Phoenix, LA Lakers, and the Warriors. Two of those teams will not be in the playoffs. Two of those teams will be in the lottery. Two of those teams are going to be looking, even not even first round exit, not even playoffs. Two of those teams are going to be in the lottery. And so, yeah, one of those may be, you know, we need to shake it up, maybe do something. I mean, I thought Sacramento would be a great partner for Zach LaVine overall. Back when this first started in November, they have not had the season that they have hoped to have. If they lose to Phoenix and then lose the matchup for the eighth seed to the Lakers or Warriors, they may go, hey, we need to shake it up because as well as we did last year, it's not happening this year and we can't contend with the rest of the West given our roster. The possibilities there. I find it difficult to believe that this team is going to look exactly what they do this season, next season. Year four of Zach, Vooch, and DeRozan together, like we've seen this movie. We don't need the fourth sequel to this movie. We've seen it before, and it's not very good. And so I think from a front office standpoint, they've got to do something now. What are they willing to accept to then unload Zach if it comes down to it? I don't know what their threshold is. But for me, if you have a team with cap space that's willing to give up a second-round pick, couple second-round picks for Zach, you've got to consider it. Now, on the flip side, a healthy Zach LaVine is an extremely efficient player, is great three-point shooter, is a great scorer. Like, he's the type of player you want on this Bulls to help spread the floor and fix the offense. So I don't think necessarily it's the worst thing in the world to bring Zach back, but, like, you need to do something from a scheme standpoint, a roster standpoint, so that we're not looking at year four of the same exact team. And I don't want them to point at Lonzo, his possible return, as the magic fix for everything that ails this Bulls team. As good as they were with Lonzo for that 30-game stretch of his first season with the team, you cannot at all publicly or even privately count on Lonzo to be anything other than a, like, the threshold for Lonzo is, can he have a normal life with his legs 15, 20 years from now? The threshold from a basketball standpoint is, can he come off the bench and play 20 minutes a night and run an offense and be a productive NBA player in a rotation? That's the threshold from an NBA standpoint. So you can't count on that to be like, oh, well, Lonzo's going to fix everything and that's what we're hoping for. No, you can't. You can't do that.
That's, yeah, the height of insanity, because the Boston Celtics are 25-25 when Lonzo was healthy, and the Cavs did not have Donovan Mitchell, and the Knicks were not where they're at now. Like, teams have so far surpassed where they were when Lonzo was playing that just bringing him back, if he was 100% healthy, wouldn't ensure us anything. And even if he is healthy, let's say he comes back and he's healthy for a year, what are you going to do? Would we seriously consider re-signing him? How could you possibly do that?
Well, I wouldn't even go that far. Look at your backcourt if Lonzo's healthy and Zach's back. Lonzo, Zach, Io, Kobe. Who's starting? Who's off the bench?
Yeah.
Are you going to sacrifice the development of Kobe and Io so that just for the sake of reasons? I don't want to see that. Like, I love what Io and Kobe have done this year, and I want to see that continue the development. I mean, if you ask me, two players who are part of whatever the next version of this Bulls team is 2 years from now, it's Io and Kobe are part of that.
Hey, I got time for one more question, and I did want to get into your kind of your overall duties a little bit. I thought it was an interesting question. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being complete indifference and apathy, and 10 being unbridled enthusiasm, where is the fan base with the Chicago major sports teams? So let's start out with the Bears.
Oh, I think it's got to be a 9 right now, right? I mean, even among the fields. Yeah, sure. Even among the fields versus Caleb debate, which clearly has been answered, and they will take Caleb with the first pick. Given that the offseason they have and certainly what they may do with that 9th pick, that's a 9 or a 10. I mean, I think the hype and enthusiasm as we get through the draft into the next NFL season, I think most of us are expecting the Bears to be a playoff contending team, not necessarily going to win 15 games, but they should win 10 or 11. I mean, everything's in place for Caleb to succeed. And so 9 or 10 is my answer for that one.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I will be one of the dissenters in this whole thing. Like, they're talking about polls like they talked about Acme in 2021, 22. Like, if you step back and look at this team, what we've done, what have we done in this administration, you know, this whole front office, we built the worst team in the league and we got the number one overall pick. There's not a lot of talent to do that. That said, you made a great trade or a good defined great passing on the
CJ Stroud. Yeah. CJ Stroud is a great quarterback. And certainly is great, but the trade worked out. I mean, they essentially got the first overall pick 2 years in a row and all the assets, including DJ Moore that they got part of that initial trade a year ago. Yeah. Like I'm okay with that. Like I get if Stroud, like it's put it this way. It, to me, it's not as bad as taking Mitch Trubisky.
No, agreed. But again, that's all dependent on if Fields ends up being a superstar and it doesn't work out. I'm a huge Caleb Williams fan, so I think it will. But if it doesn't, then that goes down as like one of the worst trades in the history of the Bears. You know, like, so I am a kind of a quasi believer in Fields. But I'm just the reason I'm pointing out, it doesn't take talent, though, to make that trade and then have Carolina suck. To make the mistake in Carolina, like the trade worked out because Carolina was so bad. So what did the Bears do? We turned Fields, who I think by any, that trade was a massive disappointment for me.
You don't even get a six-round pick this year.
Next year, you don't even get an asset this year. So there's a lot of patting on the back and saying great job here. And I have a lot. I wasn't happy with the Swift move. Yes, I love Keenan Allen at 28, 29. He's 32, and he signed for one more year. There's, like, so much more work to do here that I don't understand why everybody's acting like we're in a division with the Lions that we got to play twice, and we got to play the Packers twice. Like, right there's trouble. You know, so anyhow, let's get off of it. But I agree with you. I think the fan base is at a 12. Let's go to the Cubs. What do you think the fan base is there?
I'd say 7. I think everybody's really excited for Craig Counsell and what he can do as a manager. I don't think the roster is quite where it needs to be. But, you know, we're less than a week into the start of the season. I'd say an optimistic 7.
Agreed. I think maybe after that Bellinger hit last night, I put him at an 8.
Oh, very. I mean, they scored a lot of runs last night. Yes.
Exactly. So let's go on to the Bulls.
Mm.
Well, let's do the Hawks first. Let's do the Hawks.
Okay. The Hawks. I think optimism's purely because of Connor Bedard is probably like a 7 to an 8, just because he is everything that Hawks fans and quite frankly the NHL and league hoped he would be. I mean, he is a superstar in the making, and even with the amount of games he missed due to the broken jaw this year, he still by and large leads all NHL rookies in points and assists and goals. So, Yeah, I'd say probably for the Hawks, even though the performance on the ice this year hasn't been as great in terms of the optimism for the future, I would say it's a seven. If they get one more player in this year's draft who they hit a home run on, then I think they're going to be in a very good spot for the next decade.
Agreed. So all those are positive. Now let's go to the last two. Where do you got the Bulls?
It's interesting because the Bulls still sell out nearly every game, right? Mm-hmm. And because of the addition of the play-in tournament in the NBA landscape, they are now playing meaningful games the entire season, the last two seasons, where if that didn't exist, you'd probably see a drop off in attendance and in enthusiasm in these late March and April games. But because of the play-in, every game matters, right? Like they're vying for Atlanta for who has the right to be the ninth seed and host the play-in. If we were going back 5 years, Fred, the Bulls being a nine seed right now with virtually eliminated from catching the eighth seed, which will happen in a couple games, the fan base would be up in arms. But because you've got this addition of the play-in tournament, they're still selling out every night. And, you know, certainly I don't think the optimism is there. If we're answering the question based on optimism, I think the answer is probably for the Bulls fan base, probably a three.
I agree. I think they're one quick note, like they're hardly ever discussed on talk radio, sports radio, which I'm still Waddle and Sylvie.
It's all Bears all the time, Fred.
It's all Bears all the time, and I get rebuffed when I call in asking, hey, let's talk about the Indiana game. You're like, nah, we're doing Bears today. And it's like, it's really, I think, a negative. And I do feel like they deserve more because I do feel like Kobe and Io alone have created a beacon of hope that this team is not without hope. To have those two guys under contract at that dollar amount for the next 3 years.
Yep.
All right, that's I agree a good there. Starting spot. Finally, let's go to the White Sox, which I'm thoroughly enjoying. But what do you got them at? I'm a Cub fan who grew up on the South Side.
I mean, I think optimism for Sox fans would have to be a one, right? Like it's like
how about a negative two? Yeah, three.
I mean, it's been really, really rough off season, last season, into this season. I think just because their championship window, their contending window from their rebuild in the mid-teens resulted in two total playoff wins. That's it.
Yeah.
Two playoff wins total in the entire contending window. And now they're at the beginning stages of another rebuild. And I think that their fan base looks at it and go, what are we going to look at for the next 3 years? Like, where's my hope? Like Luis Robert is the hope, right?
Yeah. Eloy.
I don't even think they can look at Eloy as any hope. Like Eloy has a soft muscle issue every single month where he pulls a hamstring running to first base. And it's nonstop. It's constant. It's every single season. You know, so like, it's never going to be like a healthy Eloy Jimenez is an all-star. I just don't agree. There's any optimism that he's ever going to be healthy and be able to play 150 plus games in a season. I just don't think it's there. Even as a DH, he can't stay healthy. And so, I think optimism for Sox fans is at a one, and which is natural. It's normal at the beginning stages of rebuild. You just gutted your entire front office in the off season, in the late season and in the off season. So like, it's a one. I don't think anybody could argue it's more than that.
Kevin, I can't thank you enough for jumping on the bus as we bring this this beautiful vehicle into the garage. Tell us what's going on at NBC Sports Chicago, Bulls Talk. Give us the whole 411.
So, as always, I always plug Casey Johnson because he's an incredible writer, the best covering the Bulls. Check out his work at NBCSportsChicago.com. He is doing great work every single day. From a bigger picture standpoint, speaking of the play-in, the play-in games are nationally televised games, but we will be doing pre- and post-game coverage of the play-in games. So great. On that Wednesday, you will see Jason, Kendall, and Will doing a pregame show and a postgame show for what will be the Bulls-Hawks games on the 9-10 play-in on that Wednesday after the season ends. And then if they were to advance, we'll do the same thing on that Friday afterwards. And then let's all cross our fingers that they get to play four games against Boston after that. But for us, we're excited about that. And then, of course, we're doing a bunch of NFL draft coverage too. We talked about the Bears. I might as well say that during NFL draft week, we're doing a live reaction show on that Thursday of the first round. Lawrence Holmes is going to be involved. Ruthie Palinsky is going to be involved. It's going to be really cool. And we're going to have a bunch of people, a bunch of analysts in. We'll do preview NFL draft preview shows. We'll do recap stuff. It's going to be a lot of fun. So that's really what we're looking at over the course of April for us.
Kevin, can't thank you enough again. You're an incredible leader of men, incredible producer over there.
Thank you, Fred.
Most importantly, you're an incredible person. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you, Always Fred. Go Bulls.
All right, brother.